Hello, everybody. It is great to be here one more time today. My name is Gary Fowler. I'm the CEO, president, founder of GSD, Get Shit Done Venture Studios, a premier AI and quantum venture studio located in the heart of Silicon Valley. I'm a 17-time serial entrepreneur with several unicorns under the belt. I was on the original management team of Click Software, which was sold to Salesforce for $1.35 billion, and also Eva.ai, one of the first generative AI companies that I founded in 2016. Pre-transformer models. We believe at GST that intellectual capacity is evenly spread around the world, but opportunities are not. With that, I've got Chad Sanderson here today. He's a data leader with a passion for applying product thinking to holistic data challenges. He's got a journalism degree from Georgia Southern University, which given a very unique perspective on storytelling, communication, and creative direction. He's currently leading the fastest growing data quality community in the internet, Data Quality Camp, where he curates and produces content, events, and resources for data professionals. He's also a scout for Sequoia, investing in data infrastructure and machine learning products, and has a successful track record of identifying innovative and impactful data solutions from hypergrowth startups like Convoy, where he headed the data platform product team and established tech giants like Microsoft, where he managed the AI platform program. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to Chad. How you doing, Chad?
Hey, Gary. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm fantastic, like always. So, Chad, tell us a little bit about your unique journey. How do you go from journalism to becoming a data leader?
Yeah, I mean, it may sound like they're very different industries, but I think journalism and data actually have a lot of overlap. In journalism, you have to ask a lot of questions, do a lot of analysis. You're kind of trying to get to the root of some core problem, and your goal is to communicate truth as best you can to a wide audience. And it's basically what you're doing in data too. You're trying to answer questions, but instead of talking to people, you're interrogating data. And it's all really interpretation and presenting a narrative and a story to the people who are listening. So I spent a few years in Southeast Asia as a journalist. And at one of the jobs that I worked for, it was a fast-growing sort of event marketing company.
You were in Asia.
I was.
And how was that?
Oh, it was very different from the US. Things move a lot faster. There's a lot less regulation. And sometimes people don't pay you. So that's not always the case, but that was unfortunately my experience.
Where were you in Southeast Asia?
Oh, I was kind of everywhere. I was in Singapore, Malaysia, China, Philippines, Thailand. I kind of bounced around.
Why'd you do that?
I really never had any aspirations to get into tech specifically. I always wanted to be a writer. My background is in journalism and creative writing. And in terms of interesting subject matter, I was always fascinated with athletes. I thought athletes were just very interesting people. And I went to Thailand initially to cover Muay Thai athletes, some of the boxers.
I was in Thailand a couple months ago, actually. I actually had full stem cell replacement, done there twice, actually. I had 100 million stem cells put in me.
Wow, that's amazing. Didn't know they really did that in Thailand, but it's a great country. So I'm sure you enjoyed it.
Top guy in the world is there. So Dr. George at Revival. And there's been about 7,000 people that have done it. And about 700 have done it twice, and I'm one of them.
Wow.
There's a lot of Harvard, MIT, Yale-trained doctors that are in in that particular location. I mean, basically, it's a fountain of youth, right? It's Brian Johnson kind of mentality about it. But it's interesting. And how'd you like Thailand?
Oh, I thought it was great. I mean, weather is beautiful. Unfortunately, there was a bit of a military revolution happening when I was there. So that part was a little bit scary, but the people are amazing. I think the geography is amazing. It's just very different from the United States in terms of like what they value, how they act.
How different are they, Chad? What are some of the differences? I mean, you've been in each of those cultures. How different are they? You said one thing in the beginning, and I lived over in Russia, Ukraine, and I lived in Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus myself for a while, 12 years actually. And so there was a lot of different kind of freedom. Did you feel that too? Like in some ways there wasn't like the liability restrictions in the US?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that at least when it came to business, a lot of the regulation and just how like the types of securities that I think people have here in the US are generally taken for granted. A lot of those securities don't exist in sort of other places in the world. And there's like good and bad sides with that. Like the bad side is that, you know, obviously you might miss a payment for a couple weeks because the company forgets about it or is just not thinking of you, or you might be asked to do something that treads on the borderline of legality. And especially
really, so they wouldn't pay you. So you didn't get paid. And they hire you, but they wouldn't pay you. And what would they say?
Yeah, I mean, there were times where like they would send me to another country to do work, and I would sort of be living in that country for a few weeks by myself, and they would send me a text on the phone and just say, hey, we can't pay you this week, or we're not going to be able to pay you this month, or something like that. And I'm kind of stuck in this country, so I don't really have any other choice but to say, like, okay, I mean, I guess.
Oh my gosh, that's unbelievable. And then, so what did you do? That's interesting. What did you do?
Waited to get paid in most cases. I mean, eventually I left those companies because I did need something that was a little bit more stable. But I mean, there was all sorts of things like that, just because the specific industry that I worked in, which was sports, is probably it's one of the most unregulated industries just in the world. And then, you know, one of the most unregulated industries in Asia kind of puts it in a, it sort of puts you in a really tough place all the time. Like there was I can't even count how many times I had someone asking me to do something borderline illegal at the company, or like there were times where the CEO of the company was really struggling to get funding from four more legitimate sources. And so he actually ended up taking a lot of backing for his company from like loan sharks and sort of people in like Chinese mafia and stuff like that. And I ended up spending a lot of time with these people, strangely enough. There's lots of stories about that. But
were they good people or bad? Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah. I thought they were great people. I mean, there was one time where I was sitting at dinner with this loan shark, and we were just having a conversation. And I mean, he liked me. He tried to set me up with his sister. And halfway through the conversation, he was saying that, you know, if people didn't pay him his money back, he broke their legs and stuff like that. Just like casually in the conversation. But these people are speaking Mandarin, so I don't know what they're saying. I had a translator there with me. But that was a wild, very different stage of my life.
Did you meet his sister?
I did. Yeah, his sister was quite a bit older than me, so I don't know if it would have worked out. But she was a nice woman.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you went down to it. Now, what did you enjoy it? If you compare your life here in the U.S. compared to traveling like that, which country did you enjoy the most, Jack?
You know, I think I definitely enjoy doing what I'm doing in the U.S. more. I just realized for myself what brings me like pleasure or brings me happiness is building a plan and then seeing myself taking incremental steps towards that plan. In Asia, I didn't really have a plan. Things were just happening. You couldn't really afford. There wasn't really the ability to come up with a long-term plan because every month something insane would totally occur. So if you wanted interesting experiences and to meet interesting people and to just have crazy life stories and stuff like that, definitely Asia sort of takes the cake. But if you wanted to kind of work progressively towards an outcome, I think the U.S. is better for that. And that, at this stage of my life, like that's what I value a lot more.
And how long were you out of the country?
It was about 7 years.
That's a long time. Which country did you spend the most time in?
Singapore was where I spent the most. Yeah,
that was normal, though, right? I mean, because there's a lot of legal infrastructure there. It was more normal than some of the other countries.
It was more normal than some of the other ones. I still had some crazy things happen there, but it was definitely more normal than like China, for example.
Like what's crazy? What do you mean by crazy? You talked about the loan chart. So what's crazy? So for all those out there, because they're traveling around the world and they're looking at building their startup, right? What's crazy for you and how did you adapt to it?
When you mean Singapore specifically or just in general?
Yeah, just in general.
I think that the business culture out there, again, it really depends on the industry, but like in some of the countries I was in, there's not the same level of, I don't want to say professionalism, but there's not the same like structure that you have here in the US. Like if you want to build a successful company, then there's kind of a like reasonable blueprint of how to do it. And everyone sort of acknowledges what that blueprint is. You have some leadership, you come up with a strategic direction, you get in a room, you hire people with relevant skill sets, you kind of talk through a plan, you break out, you execute part of those plans. But in some of these countries, like that's just not the structure. It's very much a flying by your seat of the pants. People will just make random decisions. Like I remember one time I worked for a reality TV company over there when I was in China for a while. And I remember we sort of put together this whole plan of what we would do and how we would shoot and how we would sort of, you know, go about filming this thing. And then this guy had a feng shui master. And apparently this feng shui master had like a connection sort of in the same industry that we were in. And he brought this guy in. And it was almost like a sort of religious leadership sort of thing. And this guy just basically came in and changed everything in a day, right? And we had never seen him before. We never knew who he was. He was just this random bald guy. He just came in and changed everything, and no one ever heard of him. And those are the types of things that just happened on a regular basis that would like never happen here, right? There would never be just some random person you've never heard of before that changes the entire strategy of a company.
No, I agree. You know, that's the one thing. You gotta be open to change, that's for sure. I've seen a lot of wild stuff too. There would be changes taking place and they would be like diametric. In fact, did you ever have a situation where the changes would take place, Chad, and it was like exactly opposite what would happen in the US? Like you wouldn't, like things that you took for granted in the US that would never happen because they're too difficult would happen easily, and things that were really easy wouldn't happen. It was weird, actually.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. I saw stuff like that all the time. I mean, one of the things that I think is just, I think in a lot of places in Southeast Asia, it's sort of a look into the past of business. Like if you go back into, you know, like 80, 90, 100 years ago, and that's probably the way that business worked in the US too. But there's like, for example, there's some, I'm not saying this happens in every industry, but I saw a lot of bribes where you would have people who would say, oh, I need to, in order for me to throw an event in this particular part of the country, I need to get a license. And there's only one person in this region of China that gives out that license. And in order for you to get a license from them, like you would go and talk to them and say, hey, can I have a license, please? You would think like in the US, there would just be a standard process. Yeah, here you go. You fill out your license. In a place like China, that person would say, yeah, I know you can only get the license from me. I know that if you want to do this event on the schedule that you would like, you're going to need it within a certain amount of time. And if you want to go through the standard process, I'll get it to you in 6 months. And that'll be 3 months after your event happens. But if you want it by next week, then we can do that. You just kind of have to grease the wheels a little bit. And that type of thing happened constantly. It was all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the difference is here in the States, we call them consultants or, you know, you go down lobbyist, right, for politicians. We just label it differently. Seriously, it's amazing, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we try to make it seem, but it's interesting because you can get things done, just like you said, like right away that would take forever. I remember one time I had to get a visa and I was in a real jam because when I was on the plane, somebody took the letter that I had to get my visa. Mm. And so I was going to another country to get the visa. The letter was gone. My portfolio was gone and I'm being troubled. So I ended up in this other country. I go down and I called the guy that helped me with the visa. I said, I don't know what to do. And this was a 1-year visa.
Right.
And he said, well, what happened? I said, it's gone. He said, well, okay. So he made a connection, called the embassy and got me a visa, an entirely different visa with my name on it that would take months. And he got it right away. I mean, I literally got it right away and picked it up. I couldn't believe it, actually.
Yeah.
You know, it was something I never, ever thought would happen. So I hear you. So, you know, let's go back to, you know, you're talking about this thing with your company called the Shift Left Approach for Data. Can you tell me what that means?
Yeah, so data has a bit of an interesting technological history where it's actually older than software. sort of like early databases and early file storage systems. They had some concept of data before you had sort of big applications in the cloud and things like that. And back in the old days, what you had to do is really thoughtfully plan out.
What are the old days, Chad, for you? I'm just really curious.
Well, this would be like the 70s. I would say like mid 70s. So like, you know, 50 years ago, something like that. That's where, you know, applications weren't really a thing yet, but companies were investing really heavily into their data ecosystem. And I think the data warehouse as a concept really sort of emerged in the late 1970s, early 1980s. So what happened, or the way companies did things is they would actually organize their entire technology infrastructure around their data. So they'd say, well, you know, how does our business work? What are the nouns and verbs of our company? If we're a payment processor, our nouns are payments and customers and people and accounts and emails and credit cards and stuff like that. And those are going to become our databases. And every record in a database is like a new account or a new payment or whatever. And then you would also have your verbs, and your verbs were the things that happened to those nouns. So like a person signs up to your website, or a payment is processed, or a payment is declined. And you would have a way of capturing that information as well. And they would organize all of this in advance. And then all of your software engineers would essentially follow this structure. They would build their software, they build all their apps, they build everything else to follow the sort of data structure that's been defined. But then what happened in sort of the late 90s and sort of early 2000s was this explosion of the internet and applications and eventually the cloud. And when that happened, every single business in the world wanted to become Amazon, they wanted to become Google, they wanted to become Facebook and sort of emulate them. And the way that those companies operated is they didn't go through all this big process of defining what their data looked like and how their company worked. They just kind of let their engineers move as quickly as they needed to move and said, hey, whatever data you generate, just throw it into a big pile and we'll kind of try to make sense of it later. And that's been our operating model sort of just in the world, basically for the last 20 years. And what that's created is this huge mess of data and this mess of technology. And nobody knows what their data is. No one knows how their business actually works. No one knows how it actually connects to the technology. And if you're Google, it doesn't really matter because you're making so much money. Who cares? But if you're any other company that's not Google and you don't understand how your business works, that is a pretty severe limiting function on growth. And so the shift left approach is starting to say, hey, look, we acknowledge that the slow way of doing things in the past was wrong. We just can't go back to that. The world has moved on. However, we do want our developers to start to be thoughtful about the data that they emit and how it maps to the underlying business. And they're willing to do that because it's so unbelievably valuable. They just don't have the tools. So that's what we mean when we say shifting left. You're taking all these data strategies and you're shifting it into the hands of the software engineering organization.
Yeah, I mean, we call it infobesity. You know, I've been involved in AI for 29 years and in Silicon Valley for 39 years, building companies. So I've seen some of this stuff. I was, you know, in 1996, Google started in a trailer at Stanford. You know, I sold the first Apple two computers, not the ones, but the twos. So some of this stuff I've seen it, and you're right about it. But the problem we have is, I mean, it's just like in your world, Chad, you've had about 300,000 items in your personal cloud. The entire web in 1996 was 257,000 websites. You, Chad, have more information in your personal cloud, the entire web. The problem is Chad's trajectory is the same trajectory as the web, but that would mean doubling every year. In 5 years with the Internet of Things, you're going to have 10 million items. So the challenge we all have, I mean, you're a smart guy, but how many times in the last 2 weeks somebody said, hey, Chad, I sent you a message. Where'd you send it? You know, your Yahoo, your Google, your company. You know, could be all your .edu. When did you send it? I sent it 3 days ago. Let me check. I can't find it. So the problem we have is data. Now, what these tools are giving us is agentic tools are superpowers, right? Because they're helping us to go through this data, very, very quickly and to make sense of it for our own personal world. And that's the challenge, right? So all the companies out there, all this data infrastructure, the problem is we've been, today on the planet Earth, there's 176 zettabytes of data. If you took CDs, chat, or DVDs and put them one on top of another, today it would go 128 times between Earth and the moon, and it's grown about 70% per year. Those are the numbers. It's insane. So data is a problem. So you're right about it. We've got to go down through and understand how to take that data and understand how companies manage it, but we got to make sense of it. But we need hyper-intelligent tools like multi-agent, multimodal large language models to be able to help us make sense of it, make them, helping them work as a team. So on that point, how does increasing reliance on AI influence how data management practices should evolve, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah. So I think that we're in the, as you know, in the very early stages of AI adoption. And in the beginning of a hype cycle, there's a lot of excitement about the possibilities of the future. And so people like to experiment, try out a lot of things. They build tools that they think might be able to help them. But unfortunately, when it comes to deploying AI into businesses, I think that there's a few really major hurdles that will be quite challenging to break through. And the first that you've said, and I agree, is data. There is an enormous amount of data, and ultimately what an LLM as sort of a model that is processing information and communicating information to its users, these LLMs have to be able to actually consume this data. And just like a person, if you give a person incorrect information or information that doesn't make sense, then they're not going to give you the correct answer out the other end. So there has to be some way to validate that what is being fed into the AI is actually correct. And I don't think people really quite understand how to do that yet. The other big problem is in software engineering, really for the past 25 years or so, we've used what I would call a siloed operational model, meaning my team is based around a small number of engineers who move very, very quickly, and they're not really thinking about anybody else in the company. They're just producing the thing that matters to them. They'll generate an API to say, hey, here's the data I'm producing. If somebody wants to use this or wants to take a dependency on it, then they can. But I'm not really thinking about my consumers, and I'm not thinking about what they need. So the reality that forms is you've got this big network where every engineering team is connected to every other engineering team in hyper complex, very opaque ways. But we sort of operate as if that wasn't the case. We operate as if we're all kind of siloed and, you know, we can be completely independent. And the way that we've kind of navigated around that and overcome it up until now is that engineers are very smart and they're good at talking to each other and understanding sort of offline what those connections are. But in the world of artificial intelligence, an AI doesn't have the ability to go offline, find the engineer who owns something and ask them questions. Maybe they could do it like
online. Wait. What did you just say? Let me understand that because I know a little bit about this stuff.
Yeah. So think about it like this. Like, let's say that I've written some code, I've written an API, and because I have a very strong incentive to keep that API up to date and correct, I need to understand that this person, that the person who is consuming it is doing something very important with it, like they're processing payments. And anytime I make a change to that API, just because I know that person, I will go and talk to them and say, hey, this change is coming. How is it going to affect you? And then that person will go and look at their code and say, okay, well, I'll need to do some investigation and figure that out. Mm-hmm. But in the world of artificial intelligence, at least what exists today, and I think this is going to be improved significantly in the future, is that the AI doesn't have context of the full system outside the sort of small piece that it's been asked to do a task.
Well, it can do that. Those models, we're working on, you know, these multi-agent models that can reach out. If we're connected together, we can understand. And that's another point, because that's really where it's going to go. And we've been building some of that stuff ourselves.
What you just said is exactly the problem, which is how does it where does the connection come from? Like, if the map exists, then it absolutely can reason over the map, but a map has to exist in order for it to do that. Otherwise, there's no information for it to go and find. And the building of that map is incredibly, incredibly hard. And the reason it's hard for an AI is because, like, let's say if you're talking about a small company, then it's pretty easy. But if you're talking about a big company, like let's say a bank, for example, and you've got 100,000 lines of code in a single repo and maybe something like 1,000 files or 500 files, in order to understand what the impact of a change you're making to that software is going to be across those thousands of files, you actually need to simulate all possible permutations of the code base, right? Because you may have 1,000 different branching conditions where if this thing is true and this thing is true, then this happens. And then if some other thing is true and another thing is true, then a different thing happens. And those conditions grow sort of exponentially larger over time. And an LLM really, really struggles with sort of simulating all possible conditions of a massive, massive code base. Now, the thing is, and what companies like Cursor and Windsurf and a lot of these others do, is that they don't ask the LLM to do that, right? They actually have a compiler, which is built for exactly that type of code simulation that's running under the hood, that's figuring out how all the various paths are interconnected to each other, and then feeding the right context back to the LLM. But these types of tools are not like generally available for people quite yet, right? They're more in the hands of vendors primarily.
No, it sounds good. Listen, Chad, we're coming up to the top of the show. I didn't realize it's 11:31. So closing thoughts and how do people get a hold of you?
Closing thoughts, I think we're in a really interesting time. I think AI is going to define the next 10 years. I think that there's a whole category of infrastructure and specifically data infrastructure that will need to exist to allow the AI to do its job efficiently and effectively and with a great degree of accuracy. And that's what Gable's working on. So in terms of how you can get in contact with me, my email is chad@gable.ai. Or you can just go to my LinkedIn, just type in Chad Sanderson on LinkedIn and you'll pull me up. And I do a pretty good job at answering my LinkedIn messages.
No, it's great. So reach out to chad@gable.ai. You know, Chad, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. And thanks to all of you for joining one more time. GSD presents Top Global Startups. My name is Gary Fowler. I'm your host. Stay happy, stay safe, and stay healthy. And I'll be back to you again soon with another exciting edition. Take care. Have a nice weekend. A nice weekend, Chad. And all of you have a great weekend. Enjoy yourself. Thank you.